Okay, let's get started. I'll reintroduce Steve for the second time this morning. But Steve will give a talk on really getting to high resolution for single particle.
All right, let's see, what did I say before? All right, anyway, I'm going to have a little bit of a research talk at the beginning. I'll show you a couple of structures that we've done recently, and then I'll get into some of the technical details of how, you know, our take on getting to high resolution software-wise. I think all of the technical stuff at the end of the talk you've probably seen before in one form or another at this point. I know I've seen most of what I've got in there, but I'll have a slightly different take on it anyway. And unlike Powell's talk, which is very theoretical, I tend to give a slightly more practical-minded talk, focusing on the concepts rather than the math. So I'm glad you got a good foundation in the math before we started. Okay, so I'm going to start out with GROEL. GROEL has been sort of our canonical test specimen for the last 5 years now, something like that. Obviously, there's a crystal structure available for GROEL, so it makes a good test specimen from that case. And we also have some biological projects that we're doing with GROEL. But the native GROEL makes a very nice test specimen. It's got good contrast in the microscope. It's obviously very easy to get. And I have our little collaboration slide here. Julie Song and David Chuang are collaborators at UT Southwestern, who are very nice to provide specimen whenever we want it, and are heavily involved in the biological side of things. Anyway, so we started GROEL in about 2000, and it was a great specimen. EMAN had only been around for a couple of years at that point, and we'd used it on a couple of internal projects in the lab. So we got the GROEL specimen in the lab, and they imaged it the same day. And in less than a week, we had this nice-looking 15 angstrom resolution structure. So it was a great sort of initial test for EMAN back then. But, of course, we want to keep improving things. So the next year, we managed to make some improvements internally to EMAN and used exactly the same data set, and we got the resolution down to about 11.5 angstroms. So that's at least a little bit better. And you can sort of see here that there's a little two-helix bundle sticking out of the top of the structure here, and you kind of almost begin to make out the gap between them. But at 11.5 angstroms, you can't quite separate alpha helices yet. So we kept making some improvements, and then we collected this new data set on the Joel 2010F microscope. So this has had 30,000 particles collected on film, and we managed to get the structure down to 6 angstrom resolution. And this involved quite a few improvements to the algorithms in EMAN, a lot of which I'll talk about in the later part of the talk. So this was what we saw at 6 angstrom resolution. You can see some of these structures in here. There's this sort of characteristic 3 helices that are next to each other in here. And they're pretty well resolved, but still they're a little fuzzy in a couple of directions. That is, you can identify all of the helices, but they're not perfect in that structure. And we've done a couple of other reconstructions in that same resolution range, and it very much depends on the quality of the data that you include. We did another reconstruction at about 7 angstrom resolution using CCD data collected on the 2010F, and the helices are actually a little better defined in that structure, despite the fact that the resolution criteria says it's 7 angstroms, not 6 angstroms. So, you know, there is definitely a little bit of sort of leeway in the resolution criteria, but anyway, we collected a new data set again early this year. This was a data set we started collecting in January on the Joel 3000 microscope, and we've got a reconstruction now which I think meets Paul's criteria for being a good Fourier Shell correlation curve, and it evaluates to a resolution about 4.5 angstroms, and I hope I'll be able to convince you that it actually is. So here's just a quick image so you can see what the data looked like. So here's a sort of a section of one of the large micrographs. This data was, again, all collected on film. 7 days of imaging were involved. 910 micrographs were collected in total. All those micrographs were scanned, which gives us 1.06 angstroms per pixel on the Nikon scanners that we used. And out of the 910 micrographs that we scanned, only 135 were eventually selected for incorporation into the reconstruction. And then, of course, beyond that point, individual particles from those micrographs might also get excluded. But we started out with about 35,000 particles from the 135 micrographs. There were a variety of criteria that are used for excluding micrographs in this case. In this case, we're really interested in getting to the best possible resolution, so we excluded everything except sort of the best possible micrographs. So if there was anything wrong with the image, we threw it out. Okay. So here's the structure. We'll just sort of spin it around on the screen a little bit here, and then we'll pull out one subunit. Gurriel is a 14 mer, as hopefully most of you know. So this is 1/14 of the structure. And now you can see the helices are definitely much better resolved in the structure. We'll go ahead and sort of spin that structure around a little bit for you so you can look at it. There are helices all over this structure that you can see, and there are also a bunch of beta sheets. You can see some of the sheet-like domains up in the top of the structure. Let me go ahead and spin it one more time. You can sort of see some flat domains up there. But down in the equatorial domain here, there's quite a few alpha helices. And not only are the helices resolved, but you can actually begin to make out some of the pitch in the helices. And I'll show you a couple more interesting features as well. So let's just compare it first to the 6-angstrom resolution structure. So at least we're being self-consistent in the sense that, you know, the 6-angstrom, this 4.5-angstrom resolution structure is clearly better than the 6-angstrom resolution structure. So regardless of what you think about the various resolution criteria, at least things have improved. You can overlap them. You can see that they, you know, match pretty well. All right. So now let's see what we can do just skeletonizing the structure. So in other words, if we don't know we have a crystal, so let's say we don't know we have a crystal structure, just analyzing the density, what can we do? So we have an algorithm that goes through the structure basically does sort of a cluster analysis. It locates various points within the structure, then it connects the points and analyzes the connectivity between the various points, and then displays those as little cylinders. So the thickness of the cylinder indicates the strength of the connectivity between the between the various elements that it segmented out. And if you look at this structure, we can't quite trace the whole backbone through the structure at this resolution, but we're getting pretty close. If you look specifically in the equatorial domain of the structure, I would say we can trace the backbone almost perfectly. There's like two points at which the structure is a little ambiguous, where there's an intersection that involves four points, which sort of come, four lines which come together, and you can't tell which pair is the direction that you'd follow. But if you combine this with a little bit of ab initio modeling, it's quite clear we could easily get the backbone out of the structure. And to be honest, you could get that out at even lower resolution. Now, the apical domain in Gurriel is known to be more flexible than the equatorial domain. So you always see a little bit more smearing at whatever resolution you're at up here than you do down here. We actually impose the full 14-fold symmetry on this structure. So any motion that's going on there in the apical domain is just getting motion averaged in. And that's a little bit different than in the crystal structure. In the crystal structure, they had 7 different structures for the different monomers. There were clearly some crystal packing forces because it was sort of the shape of the Gurriel was sort of slightly distorted in the reconstruction. In the previous structure, in the 6-angstrom structure, we actually analyzed that and we showed a couple of helices that were actually moving up to 5 or 6 angstroms with respect to the crystal structure, and that holds up in this particular analysis as well. So let me go ahead and bring some of the density back so you can sort of see how the density matches a little bit better with the structure. And let's see what other features we can see. So we'll rotate around back here. We can see some more helices that are nicely defined in the structure here. Of course, I can't see them very well from back behind this podium. But there's a bunch of additional helices that are defined. Now I want to call your attention to this right here. So we have this feature which is a little bit bigger than a helix. And there's sort of clear separation between this side and this other side. If we now overlay the crystal structure, you'll see that this is actually a small, two-strand beta sheet, and we're actually resolving the strands in the beta sheet. So this is sort of our real criteria for saying that we think we've gotten past 5-angstrom resolution because we can actually see this separation and it matches a known structure. So we say, all right, we're pretty confident that's a valid measure. So let's do one last thing. A typical question is, okay, so you've got this cryo-EM reconstruction. What happens when you compare it to the crystal structure? And as Powell sort of implied, things are great until you get to about 10 angstrom resolution in that respect. So when we published the 11.5-angstrom resolution structure, you do the FSC that you calculate between the two halves of the data, and you do the FSC between the crystal structure and the cryo-EM structure, and you get 11.5 angstroms both ways, and everything looks terrific. When you do the 6-angstrom resolution structure, it gets a little better. It gets down to about 8-angstrom, 9-angstrom resolution, but then the structures stop agreeing. Now, of course, part of that is the fact that some of the helices were actually moving. And it wasn't a resolution issue because, you know, the helices were well-defined in our structure and well-defined in the other structure. But that doesn't completely answer the question either. Another question you have to ask is, well, how are you going to compare your crystal structure to the crystal structure to the cryo-EM structure? And that's also not a real obvious question. You say, well, you've got a crystal structure, you've got a PDB model, why don't you compare the PDB model to that? But that's not entirely a fair test, because the PDB model is an interpretation of the electron density that was determined by the crystallography experiment. So really what you should be comparing is the electron density from the crystallography experiment with the electron density from the cryo-EM experiment. So I have a collaboration with Paul Adams, not on GROEL, but anyway, Paul Adams was intimately involved in solving the crystal structure. So I managed to get him his best interpretation of the electron density that was involved in producing the PDB model. Okay, so this is the experimental data from the crystallography experiment. And you can't really get that strictly from the structure factors that go into the PDB. There's a little bit more involved. According to Paul, this is close. Not exactly probably what was used, but it's close. So we've got the crystal structure over here, which has been blurred out to 4.5 angstroms. The crystal structure was more like 2 angstroms. I think the final one they got was getting close to 2. So we blurred it out a little bit. And you can see that the structures look pretty similar to each other. Now, there's a few thresholding differences, right? You'll notice up here this connects all the way down here. And if I lower my isosurface threshold, then I'll see that connectivity here as well. But if I lower the isosurface threshold, then the connectivity down here won't look as much like that. So there's some sort of low-frequency noise still in the model, which makes the thresholding a little tricky. But basically, all of the features are pretty well represented. Now, we can do one more thing here. We can lower the threshold a little bit, and now you can see some of this noise in the crystal structure as well in pink. But you'll notice now there's this connection here. This is where two large side chains are adjacent to each other in these two helices. And if you look over in the cryo-EM map, you see a little connection there as well. Now, I am far from claiming that we're seeing side chains, but I'm saying in this particular case, we're beginning to get to the point where we're seeing, you know, evidence of large side chains anyway. So you can see that matches very nicely. And if we rotate the structures around, hang on a sec. We'll rotate the structures around, and now if you look at this place where I was saying we were resolving the beta sheet, you can see that there's actually a very nice match in the shape of those structures. So I think we're pretty confident that we've actually gotten past 5 angstrom resolution at this point.
Can you calculate?
You can, and so if you calculate the Fourier shell correlation between this map and that map, it looks absolutely awful. Okay, when you see that, you say, "Oh well, what's going on there?" So then you say, "Well, what happens? Why don't we try calculating the FSC between the crystal structure and the PDB model?" So you take the PDB model and make an electron density map from that, and then compare it using an FSC, and that also looks awful. It's simply the fact that the criteria you use in the two fields just really aren't very compatible. And this data set is old enough. Over the years, they've been sort of reinterpreting the same data set from the 90s. And the data set is old enough that this was before the crystallography community started really using some of the low-resolution terms. So there was this sort of trend in the crystallography community that anything below, you know, like 15 angstroms or 18 angstroms or something like that, they just threw out. And they didn't use it in the reconstruction. So that means is when you calculate the FSC between this and the PDB model, you see at low resolution it's like 0. And then somewhere in the intermediate resolutions it pops up to 1, and then it comes down and does all sorts of funny things after that point. So it's comparing the structures other than sort of this visual sort of comparison of what features you can see is really very tricky. Did that answer the question you asked originally? I forgot what the question was. Okay. All right. So I'm going to give one other example, which is the calcium release channel. This is a structure that we've been working on for a very long time. This work actually predates me going to Baylor College of Medicine in 96. Irina Sarasheva has been working on it since 92, I think, something like that. And they published a structure in the just around the time I was first joining the lab. They published a structure at sort of about 30 angstrom resolution by modern terms. And yeah, let's see. All right, let me give you a little background here of the calcium release channel first. So the calcium release channel is actually, there's three isoforms. The isoform we're talking about here is RYR1, and is found in the SR membranes in muscle tissue. And it's basically, this is the channel that's responsible for releasing the calcium that initiates the cross-bridge cycle and makes the muscles contract. And it gets triggered by some sort of a direct connection to the dihydropyridine receptor in the opposing T2 tubule membrane. So the nerve impulse comes in, triggers the dihydropyridine receptor in the T-tubule. The DHPR then triggers the calcium release channel, releases a burst of calcium, the muscle contracts, and then there are these calcium pumps also in the SR membrane, which are continuously pumping any calcium that's on the outside back into the SR again. Now, you also see a calcium release channel in the brain and at a variety of organs in the body in lower concentrations, but its concentration is highest in the muscle tissue. So this is actually purified, not expressed protein. It's very large. This is the largest known ion channel. It's 2.2 megadaltons. Here's a micrograph showing the calcium release channel. Now this is the micrograph for the final structure that I'm going to show you, from the final structure I'm going to show you at the end of the talk. This part of the talk, anyway. This was imaged on the 2010F with no continuous carbon. This was actually one of the big issues over time. Originally we could not get this specimen imaged without continuous carbon. If you did it without carbon, you just got nothing in the ice, or you saw like two particles in the whole frame, or something like that. And over the years, Irina finally worked out a protocol which would allow her to image it without the continuous carbon, and that has made a dramatic impact on the resolution of the reconstruction, and on the contrast of the images, and also it has gotten rid of the preferred orientation. So when we had the continuous carbon film, you only saw top views of the molecule, basically. I mean, you saw a few occasional side views. We got rid of the carbon film. Now our distribution of orientations is almost isotropic. So this was a 30 angstrom resolution structure that was published, I think it was 94 or 93, something like that. So this is the transmembrane domain here. This is the stuff sticking out into the cytosol, so the dihydropyridine receptor would sit up here and then somehow make a contact with this clamp-shaped domain in the corner. So aside from sort of the gross morphology of the channel, you can't really get very much out at 30 angstrom resolution. So we kept working on it, and we worked for a very long time. What was I demonstrating there? All right, we're going to skip that part. So then we managed to, I joined the group, and I started doing some CTF correction on the model. So that initial structure that was published was not CTF corrected at all. And in fact, at that point in time, none of the single particle reconstruction software out there, Spider to Magic was basically all that really existed at the time. None of those packages were capable of doing any CTF correction, basically, or at least none of them had it integrated in any way that anyone could really use it. So my first project in the lab was to implement CTF correction within the IMAGIC reconstruction procedure. This was what happened. So we did the CTF correction. We got the structure from 20 angstrom or 30 angstrom resolution down to 20 angstrom resolution, and you can see it's slightly more detailed than the old structure, but not exceptionally exciting still. Now, the next step we made was we got to 14 angstrom resolution, and this was actually done with the same data set that we use in the 20 angstrom resolution structure. When I made the various improvements that we made to EMAN to go from 11 angstroms on GROEL to 6 angstroms on GROEL, and then we applied those improvements to the calcium release channel, we managed to get that structure down to 14 angstroms. And this is a little bit better. Now you're beginning to be able to see some of the... Let's see if this is an animation or not. I don't recall. What's my mouse? Oh, there it is. Not. So at this resolution, you're beginning to be able to see some of the subunit separations in the structure a little bit. You can see some domains, but still there's a limited amount you can do. One of the big problems with the calcium release channel is it has almost no homologies to anything, anywhere. I mean, people have looked through the whole sequence for any sort of homologies. There's a couple of tiny homologies to sections of the IP3 receptor, which is fairly closely related, but as far as sequence homology goes, there's virtually nothing there. Now, it's believed that there's probably some structural homology to some of the potassium channels, and I'll show you that at the end of the talk here. So now what we've got is a 9.6 angstrom resolution structure, and you can see it's a lot more detailed, looks sort of lumpy. Now, again, this is a thresholding issue. If you raise the isosurface threshold here substantially, then you'll begin to see sort of the, some of the tube structures that you expect for the helices that are beginning to become apparent and that sort of thing. But you won't see the whole structure. It won't look as connected that way. So we'll just spin that around real quick first. So again, the transmembrane domain is passing us by right there. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the transmembrane domain in a little bit of detail and see what we can find out at this resolution. Now, at sort of the 10 angstrom-ish resolution that we're at here, you are going to be able to begin resolving helices. So helices that are sort of well separated in the structure, you'll be able to resolve, but other helices that are too close together will look kind of funny, and it, you know, sometimes you'll have beta sheets which will look kind of like a helix in certain cases and stuff like that. So you have to be very cautious in your interpretation of maps at this kind of resolution. Nonetheless, we're going to see what we can get out. So this is just sort of the overall architecture. Here's the transmembrane domain, and it's a homotetramer. This indicates the sort of separation that we've assigned so far for the subunits. So now we've got a little movie here. So this documents sort of the segmentation process of the transmembrane domain. So what we're going to do is we're going to chop out this transmembrane domain and just look at that, and we're going to ignore all of the cytosolic domain. So we'll play with the isosurface threshold, raise the threshold a little bit so you can begin to see some of the detailed internal features there, and then we'll go in and we'll try and place helices in the structure. So we'll look for things visually that look like they could be helices and dock them in. Now, this just gives you an idea of the scope of this map. I mean, this map is just humongous. So we'll go ahead and put some helices into the map. Now, when you look at this, you say, well, I can see that there might be helical-like densities in there, but it looks like some of the other densities that you're not calling helices might also be helices. And you're right. Some of the other densities could be helices. What we did when we did this process was a two-stage interpretation of the data. We have an automatic program called Helix Hunter, which will go through the maps and use a variety of numerical criteria to assess whether particular features that you see are helices or not. So Helix Hunter does an assignment of what it thinks helices are, and then we independently have a person sit down, and they go through the map, and they decide what they think helices are, and what you're seeing are the intersection of those two results. So we're only putting things in here that we were pretty confident from both measures were actually helices in the structure. Okay, so that's the pattern of helices that we found. We found basically five helices that we were really confident about in each subunit in the transmembrane domain. So, Arena said, okay, I'm going to take a look at how this compares to some of the potassium channels. Now, at the same time we were doing this analysis, a paper came out, some of you might not be familiar with, had a structure at a comparable resolution, and they made a claim that at least in their model, the transmembrane domain looked like the KCSA potassium channel. So there aren't very many transmembrane channels that have crystal structures out there, even of the transmembrane domain, but there are a few out there, and the KCSA channel is one of them. So this is the structure of the helices for the KCSA channel. This is the structure of the helices that we got. You can see they don't really match very well at all. So Arena looked around at the other potassium channel structures that are out there and found the MTHK structure. And the MTHK structure, well, that looks a lot more like the structure that we saw. And I'm going to sort of skip over some of this sequence alignment stuff that we did up here, where we were trying to identify where in the sequence the various helices were and you know, based on the structural assignment that we did. Yeah, that MTHK is from an X-ray structure. Yeah, both the KCSA and the MTHK are the poor region for which a crystal structure exists. Now they don't have the whole channels, but they crystallize the poor regions. Absolutely. You can't crystallize membrane. I mean, you can't do single particle reconstruction on membrane proteins without solubilizing them. So we have a very mild detergent in there, but yeah, it's detergent solubilized. So that actually is one of the reasons why when you do these membrane protein reconstructions, they look a little different than some of the really soluble protein reconstructions. When you do GROEL at a particular isosurface threshold, I mean, it really stands out, and the features, internal features, tend to stand out even at the threshold where you can sort of see the whole structure. But when you do some of these detergent-solubilized structures, there are some subtle differences. And in particular, if you look at the transmembrane domain at even lower thresholds, you still see some sort of random densities just outside the map. And typically in natively soluble proteins, at the edge of the structure, it just sort of stops. So there's definitely some random detergent floating around on the outside. If we overlap all of these structures, it becomes... All right, I'm going to skip over this hinge stuff.
Huh?
Yeah, I know. I'm sure he did. Yeah. We recognized there was going to be a little overlap when we were talking about this stuff. So this is the final comparison. Did he show this at the end?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Now, this doesn't look very good unless you've got it in 3D. And in the paper, we actually put a stereo pair in there, as you could tell. So our structure definitely matched the MTHK structure, but didn't match the KCSA channel at all. Now, the funny thing about that is the KCSA channel is a closed channel, and the MTHK channel is supposed to be in the open state, whereas our structure is supposed to be in the closed state. And it was believed that the kinking of that helix was involved in opening the channel, but there's a little question about that result now. So I know why I gave an overview of that, and I don't know exactly what he said because I wasn't here. So we'll just sort of move on from that point. In any case, we've got the structure of a membrane protein now down to about 10 angstrom resolution, and membrane proteins in general are definitely harder to work with than soluble proteins. So they're always going to sort of lag behind. One point I'd like to make is that the second structure I showed, the calcium release channel, was done on CCD. And the first structure I showed was done on film. So there's always some of these questions about, well, why are you still using film? Why aren't you doing everything on CCD? So this is just a comparison of carbon film power spectrum collected on the film and on the CCD camera on the 2010F microscope under as identical conditions as we possibly could get them. So what you'll see is that the CCD actually has this sort of amplification at low resolution, but then at high resolution it tends to fall off much faster. Whereas on film, the fall off is much more gradual at high resolution. So it's actually, the CCD is actually nice in a number of respects, because you get this almost 50% improvement in low resolution contrast versus film on the CCD camera. But when you're trying to achieve high resolution structures, that means, because of this fall off, that means that you have to use higher and higher magnifications, which means you get fewer and fewer particles in the CCD frame, which makes it harder and harder to determine the CTF parameters that you need to do the reconstruction. So we've done four different reconstructions now using the CCD camera on the 2010F microscope. One was a virus, one was GROEL, one was the calcium release channel. I'm completely blanking out on what the fourth one was. But each of those were done at different magnifications. And in every case, at least on that microscope and that particular camera, the resolution we could get to was 2/5 Nyquist. Okay, so 2/5 of the way to the edge of Fourier space there. That was the resolution, the best resolution we could achieve in each case. Didn't seem to matter how much data we put into it. In the case of the virus reconstruction, he had 10 times more data than he should have needed to push the resolution. I mean, he could use 1/10 of the data and get to 2/5 Nyquist, and he put in all of the data, and he still only got to 2/5 Nyquist. So something is going on there that sort of limits the resolution to that point. But given that limitation, CCD cameras are obviously still very useful. But if you're looking at something large like a herpes virus capsid or something like that, then if you want to get to high resolution, you'd only get, say, one particle per frame. And that's not so useful. So the area that you get in the usable area that you get in a piece of film is still about 20 times what you get in a single CCD frame. So there's a definite trade-off there. Now, of course, no one likes developing film, and there's a lot of other issues you have to deal with in that case. No one wants to scan it. So for the very highest resolution structures, we're still using film right now, but we're beginning to shift most of the other sort of the routine structures down to CCD camera. So I'd say for typical structures going down to 6 to 8 angstrom resolution, I don't see any problems with CCD cameras. Did you want to ask a question?
You answered it.
Oh, okay. All right. Now I want to talk about some of the more technical aspects. What is it that we did to achieve the resolution that we have in some of the structures, and sort of how we do refinements as compared to some of the other packages. So this is sort of the overview of the refinement methodology used in EMAN. We start out with some sort of initial three-dimensional model. We start out with a large set of particle images, and then we go through this refinement loop. And this loop is very similar to what you've seen in some of the other packages. There are differences from one package to another, and in the EMAN tutorial, we're going through some of the details of the differences between the packages a little bit, but I'll just take you through this process. So EMAN uses a projection-based classification of the particles. So it's not a reference-free classification. It's a reference-based classification algorithm. The main difference, I'd say, between sort of a canonical spider reconstruction and the normal EMAN reconstruction is at this stage right here. So let's go through the process. So we're going to start out with our initial model. And I'm demonstrating here that the radius of convergence of this algorithm is actually quite large. So we're going to use an elliptical Gaussian as a starting model. So we make projections of our elliptical Gaussian all possible orientations. And you can tell that there's some difference from one orientation to another, but it's really just a smear in space. Then we classify our particles. So we try and find particles that look more like that than any of the other projections. Now, at this point in the process, there is a slight bias, but the assignment is almost random. Okay, I mean, it's not completely random. There is some bias. This direction looks a little different than this direction, so we're going to end up with hopefully a few more things that look like end views here and a few less things that look like end on views here. But you know, it's not very well defined at this point. Then we generate our class averages. So we take all these particles and the other 500 that I didn't show you, and we align them to each other and average them together and produce a class average. So this is the class average, and this is the projection, class average, projection, et cetera. Then we take these class averages and we use those to build a new three-dimensional model. Now, we know the orientations of all of these class averages because the class averages are referring back to a particular projection in the original structure. And in this first iteration, of course, well, we get something that looks a lot better than this the spherical, sorry, this Gaussian that we started out with, but it still doesn't look quite like Gouriel. Now, if we continue refining through this loop, so now we take this and use that as an initial model, things rapidly start converging. And I'll take you through the convergence step by step in a second. So this is later in the refinement process. We're now making projections of what looks a lot like Gouriel. Now we're classifying based on these projections, and you can see now the classification makes a lot more sense. And over here we've got our projections and our class averages, and you can see now the projections and class averages agree very nicely. Then we make our final 3D. Eventually we make our final 3D model. So we'll go through this step by step. So we're going to start with this. After one iteration through the loop, we got that, which is what I showed you in the previous slide. After one more iteration, we get something like that. One more iteration, and now it's beginning to sort of figure out what the shape of the structure is. Now, I'll point out that we're imposing symmetry in this process. One more iteration, now it actually looks like the right shape. I mean, this is the basic shape of Gouriel. One more iteration, and now the detailed features have come out. We can again sort of see this little two-helix bundle sticking out of the surface. So in a typical refinement, even if you start with a really, really awful initial starting model, usually it only takes about 8 iterations to converge to your final structure, basically. Go ahead. So it depends a lot on the structure. So I would say, as sort of a rule of thumb, if you have a particle that is very homogeneous but has no symmetry, you're okay 9 times out of 10. If it's really just shaped like a ball and has very few internal features, then obviously you're screwed. There's not much you can do. But if it's got any shape at all, I mean, if it's something like the ribosome, right? It was kind of elliptical in shape. Well, anyway, it's not spherical. So if you have something like the ribosome and it's reasonably homogeneous, there's no problems at all. However, if you have heterogeneity, substantial structural heterogeneity, then and no symmetry, then you can start running into problems. Then you can run into cases where if you try and subclassify the particles, make multiple models from, you can take a single data set, and there's a corresponding routine which actually generates say, five different models from a single data set simultaneously. So if in each case, instead of just classifying the particles based on orientation, you also classify them based on which of the models they match the best. Those routines can get kind of risky in certain cases because it's possible to end up having one set of orientations end up grouping into a particular model instead of one set of heterogeneous particles grouping into a particular model. So it may get split by orientation instead of by heterogeneity. And there's all sorts of complexities involved. But sort of as a rule of thumb, if you have either symmetry or a homogeneous specimen, you're probably okay. Now, in the case of a completely asymmetric structure, I definitely recommend starting from, say, three or four different initial starting models and going through the whole refinement process for all of the different starting models and making sure that you converge to the same thing. And if you don't converge to the same thing, then you have to start looking in detail and trying to figure out what's going on. Typically, what will happen, even in a bad case, is you'll do, say, five different refinements from different starting models, and three of them may be different, a couple of them may look kind of like each other, but then if you do a resolution assessment, you'll find that the wrong structures don't converge to very high resolution, whereas the right structure is sort of snapped into place, and you'll see this big jump, and it'll get to much higher resolution. So there are some diagnostics you can use to figure out when you've gone wrong. Okay, how do we get to higher resolution? Well, step one, you have to have a good microscope. The only reason we managed to get to 4.5 angstrom resolution rather than the 6 angstrom resolution was Yoshi's style microscope, the Joel 3000 microscope. When it's working, gives the best data that we've ever seen on any microscope. Now, it's only working about 20% of the time because it's very difficult to keep it operating. But when it's working, it produces the best possible data. So that's still the microscope that we use. You know, it has the top entry holder instead of the side entry holder, so it's very, very stable. It's liquid helium stage, and there's a lot of dispute over whether liquid helium has any usefulness or not. And I would say for single particle imaging, all of the evidence that we've collected implies that you can increase the dose by about 30 to 50% safely at liquid helium temperatures for single particle imaging. Now, for tomography, there's a whole different story. That really made all the difference in making that particular resolution jump. Other thing, the microscopist actually really does play a pretty big role. And I would tend to argue that even in the case of the automation systems, the guy who sits down and aligns the microscope and makes sure the specimen is loaded properly really can have a big impact on the final results of the structure. Eventually, it'll be nice if that's not the case anymore, but at least in our case, there are definitely people in the lab who take better images than other people in the lab. And generally speaking, the people who take the best images are working on the best microscopes. So, yeah. Okay, and then the last step is, of course, we can make improvements to the algorithms. So what sorts of improvements have we made over the years to start, to sort of gradually improve the resolution? So the first thing I'll talk about is sort of CTF correction. And this is kind of old stuff. I mean, this is stuff, like I said, I mean, I did that back in sort of the Imagic days, before Eman was even written. And this is probably very similar to some of the stuff that you saw before. Basically, the measured signal, so we're working in Fourier space here, and we're working in polar coordinates in Fourier space. So this is spatial frequency, and this is the angle in the polar coordinates. And the vector sign indicates that it's a complex number, not just a real number. So the Fourier transform of the micrograph that you collect, or of the an image of a particle that you collect, is what we're going to call M here. That's measured. Then F is the structure factor of the specimen. So that is the Fourier transform of the perfect particle without any noise or anything like that. So the ideal specimen, you take its Fourier transform, and that would be F. Then we have the contrast transfer function, and then we have an envelope function, and then we have this horrible additive noise. Now, you'll notice that in the equation that I'm showing here, the CTF and the envelope function are only functions of spatial frequency, and they're not vector quantities. So they are both real-valued quantities in the simple approximation, the weak phase approximation that everyone uses. And the fact that I'm saying that they're not function of angle implies that I'm not going to take astigmatism or drift into account. Okay? So the derivation is just a lot simpler if we ignore those things. Both of those things can be taken into account in a reasonably straightforward manner in the math, but for the moment we're going to ignore those. So that leads us to the equation down here. This is actually looking at the whole Fourier transform amplitudes and phases, the whole thing. Down here, what we're going to say is we're going to characterize the micrographs based on the power spectrum. So the problem with trying to work up here is the fact that we don't know what this noise, we don't know this noise. The noise is random by definition. However, we can characterize the spectral profile of the noise. So down here, what we're basically doing is we're taking the modulus, in other words, the length of the vector of the complex vectors, and then we're doing a rotational average. So we're averaging, we're integrating over theta here, and that gives us our single one-dimensional power spectrum that we can then use to determine the CTF parameters of the micrograph. Again, in the absence of astigmatism and drift. So Eman uses an 8-parameter model for this. We have the defocus, we have the amplitude contrast, the width of the envelope function, and we currently treat the envelope function as just a single simple Gaussian. I mean, Joachim has a paper which describes a nice five-parameter model for the envelope function, which incorporates all of the various physical effects that might contribute to it. But empirically, we found that a Gaussian works pretty well for most microscopes in most cases, you really can't get 5 parameters out of what's available for you in the data, basically. The system becomes degenerate. So I should say that there's one caveat to this, which is, for some reason, the Joule 3000 doesn't produce Gaussian envelope functions. It seems to produce envelope functions which look much more like just an exponential falloff. And that's actually one of the reasons why we get so much signal out at high resolution. I do not know why that's the case. The theoretical envelope functions don't match it in any particular way. We've tried to match it to the 5 parameters, you know, knowing the theoretical values and stuff, but empirically, the Gaussian function that we get out of the Joule 3000 on film is much more like an exponential decay. So there's an alternative in Eman where you can either use a Gaussian or an exponential as the envelope function shape. Then we have the overall amplitude of the CTF, and then we have this four noise parameters, and so basically we have this sort of empirical model for the spectral profile of the noise. So let's just take a look at this real quick. So the black line shows M sub S. So that's the power. I took the individual boxed out particles from the micrograph. I calculated their power spectra, and then I averaged all those power spectra together, so covering all the different orientations that were present in the micrograph. And that's what that black curve represents. Okay, the blue curve represents the fit, excluding the structure factor. Okay, so this is just the fit, including the envelope function and the CTF of the micrograph with the added background noise. Then the red curve represents the fitted background noise using Eman's 4-parameter empirical model. Now the idea for the noise is, of course, you know that at these zero crossings that there's no signal present. So we can just draw a curve that fits through all of these things. And then, of course, we don't have a zero crossing at the origin, so we just have to sort of smoothly interpolate through here. Now there are other things that you can do. If you take a series of micrographs covering a wide range of defocuses, then you can shift this first zero crossing towards the origin, and that'll help you sort of build up a noise curve that's the same for all of the different models. But it turns out that this empirical model does a pretty nice job of fitting where this curve will tend to go as it moves towards the origin. And for the most part, this is just an exponential, although there's also a Gaussian term which is used to sort of damp things off a little bit more at high resolution. And the bottom line is, we're not using this information that we get from the fit for anything that's dependent on high accuracy. So if we have say a 5 or 10% error in the amplitude of the noise in this curve, it won't really affect our final results very much. We'll use it in Wiener filters, and we'll use it as weights in combining the different data together. And small errors like that don't really have much effect. So even if it doesn't fit perfectly, it's not a big deal. So the basic idea is we do a fit like this. Now let's actually show the full. Oops. All right. So now here's the full fit once we've incorporated a structure factor. So the idea is we're going to then try and use the 8-parameter model in conjunction with some sort of a structure factor to get the best possible fit that we can. Now the slide I skipped over here is showing an X-ray solution scattering experiment that we performed on Groyel to get its structure factor. So what you get out of an X-ray solution scattering experiment is exactly what you need to do this fitting operation. And I say, well, an X-ray solution scattering experiment takes an awful lot of time and effort, and I don't have enough specimen to put in the beamline to do that, so I can't get a curve like this. And that's probably true 9 times out of 10. To do a solution scattering experiment out to the sort of resolutions we're talking about here, you have to have on the order of maybe half a mil of protein at better than 1 mg/mL concentration. So if you're expressing your protein, you're probably okay. But if you're purifying it, in most cases, you're not going to have enough concentration or enough specimen to waste on a crystal on one of these solution scattering experiments. And it turns out that if you go to the protein data bank and you take protein molecules of all different shapes from the PDB and then sort of generate a synthetic structure factor based on those, one of these one-dimensional structure factors, you'll find that they all, for proteins, they all have basically the same shape. If you plot all of those different molecules together on a log scale next to each other, you'll find that at high resolution in this regime, the only real difference you see is that if you have more beta sheet content, you see it get a little bit higher in sort of the 5 angstrom range. And if you have more helical content, you see it get a little higher in the 10 angstrom range. But aside from that sort of subtle variation, which is maybe as much as a factor of 2 or something, the curves are basically the same out at high resolution. Now, you see a lot of variation at low resolution. Okay, the low resolution is really where sort of the shape of the particle is defined. So what we want to do is come up with a mechanism where we can extract the low resolution structure factor information directly from the cryo-EM data and then combine that with a sort of a typical canonical structure factor at high resolution, which is reasonably good for fitting all proteins. And I don't have enough time to go into great detail on how we accomplish that in this talk. We sort of went over it a little bit in the EMAN tutorial yesterday and spent about an hour doing it. So there is a mechanism for doing that. Now, when we do this fit, you'll notice that the blue curve, which is the theoretical curve, including the experimental structure factor, doesn't perfectly match what we got out of the electron micrographs. And the reason for that is Gros-EL, when it sits in the slide, is in a preferred orientation. So Gros-EL tends to sit in the side view and in the top view, and very little in between. Now, it has all of the different side views. So you get, I mean, which is all you really need to do a reconstruction. In other words, you have sort of tomographic sampling in addition to the top views. So it's not a problem for reconstruction purposes, but the solution scattering experiment, the molecules are tumbling around randomly in solution, so it's isotropic. And in the case of the cryo-EM curve, it's not isotropic. So how do we do the correction? So we're going to treat this as sort of a simple least squares problem, and we're going to ask this question. I'm going to combine identical images, using some weighting factor in Fourier space. So basically, I'm going to apply some linear operation to each of the images as a function of spatial frequency and potentially angle, but mostly as a function of spatial frequency. I'm going to apply some weight to each image as I average them together. So basically, I'm taking a weighted average in Fourier space. Now, if you ask the question, what can we do to both maximize the signal-to-noise ratio of the average and to minimize the variance between the average and the theoretical image without any noise. If you solve that mathematical expression, what you get is this expression up here. And this expression the Wiener filter actually pops out of that solution as one term in this expression. So you basically end up with three components to this CTF correction expression. There's a Wiener filter term. There's a CTF correction term, which is you just divide through by the CTF and the envelope function. Now, if you look at that carefully, you say, well, I'm dividing through by something that goes through zero, right? So I'm going to get infinities every time that crosses zero. However, there's another term here, which is a signal-to-noise ratio weight term. So this is the signal-to-noise ratio of a single micrograph divided by the sum of the signal-to-noise ratios of all the micrographs. So that means that if the CTF goes to zero in a particular micrograph, the signal-to-noise ratio also goes to zero. So you end up with zero over infinity, and it ends up being zero in the final answer. So as you're approaching the zeros, the information from a particular micrograph gets weighted less and less and less. And then the other micrographs that are sort of filling in the missing data from the zeros contribute more and more and more. So this is sort of a shifting filter taking into account the amount of information that should be present in each micrograph. Now, in a lot of the 3D reconstruction packages, they don't get this complicated in the parameter fitting. For example, Magic still typically you just determine the defocus of the micrograph, and then you flip the phases in Fourier space, and that's all you do. You don't do any amplitude corrections or anything like that. So we actually make use of this fitting process, this 8-parameter fitting, for a bunch of different purposes. Not only do we use it to do the final CTF correction here, but we also use it, for example, when we're doing particle alignments. We use a signal-to-noise ratio weight when we're doing those alignments. So it allows us to do things like Wiener filters. It allows us to properly weight things when we're doing all of the various image processing operations we have to do in that refinement loop. So it's not just used in a very simple way. So when people come and ask me and they say, well, I've determined my CTF parameters and my defocus in some other program, and how can I get those into Eman and use them? And I tell them they can't. You have to actually have the right values. Yes, if you want to get optimal results using Eman's scheme, you have to know the 8-parameter model because it uses it for so many different things. If you don't do that, you can still get a reconstruction. And if you're just trying to get a 20 angstrom resolution reconstruction or something like that, you can ignore all this CTF correction stuff, basically. But if you want to get optimal results, you really have to do that. OK, next topic, image classification. Now, say we have a particle here. Now, I'm leaving noise out of this discussion. So say we have a particle here, and we need to determine its orientation. Now, I want to start by pointing out that the question isn't whether the program can decide whether it looks more like this or more like this. If the program can't decide whether this looks more like this or more like this, you should probably be looking for a new software package. And the question isn't even whether this particle looks more like this or more like this. This is also actually a very easy question. The question is, can the program decide whether this looks more like this or more like this? And even if you look at these very carefully and switch back and forth, there are very small variations between them. These are actual projections of the Gros-Yell model with a 1-degree separation. Okay, and when you're doing a 4.5 angstrom resolution reconstruction, you have to sample that finely. And particularly if you're like doing a big virus capsid or something like that, I mean, you have to do 0.5-degree spacing then. So, you know, the question of trying to assign do classification here, there's no issue there. The only problem comes into play when you're trying to decide these sorts of things, where you've got a really noisy particle, and you've got very tiny variations between the two projections that you're trying to match the best. So I'm going to go through a couple of the different things that we have to take into account when we're trying to do that process. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to talk about basically affects the classification portion of the procedure. Okay, I'll be talking about a couple of other things that affect other parts of the reconstruction. So let's start out with the alignment issue. So when we wrote the initial version of Eman, we said, well, we're already limiting ourselves to two-thirds Nyquist. I mean, we're saying that our final reconstruction, we can't have anything that's any resolution that's beyond two-thirds Nyquist, we're going to say is going to have artifacts and stuff like that. So we're already limiting ourselves to a fraction of the available information in Fourier space. So really, when we're aligning the particles for purposes of classification, we can probably do it with, say, plus or minus half a pixel accuracy and call that good enough. So in other words, you find the best single pixel shift, which gives you the best match between the particles. However, it turns out that there's a problem with that. So we're going to do this in 1D because it's a little easier to see. So this is our ideal function. Now, of course, when we take an image, we're sampling that function at individual peaks. So each of these lines represents a pixel position in this function, basically. So what we actually will see when we collect our data in the microscope is this jagged-looking curve down here. Okay? Now, let's say, for the sake of argument, that the image that we collected on film is shifted half a pixel from the projection, the final reconstruction that we're doing. I mean, the particle could be positioned anywhere between pixels in space, right? So let's say it's off by half a pixel. Okay. So let's now interpolate this model at half a pixel shift with respect to what we did here. Now we get this curve like that. Now we're going to do a 1-pixel shift accuracy alignment between this and this, and we get something like that. You say, well, okay, those match pretty well, right? And you're right, they match pretty well. And if we were trying to determine top view versus side view, no problem, works great. However, you'll note that there is a lot of vertical separation between the red curve and the black curve here in certain places. That vertical separation, when you're calculating the variance between two images, or whatever your image similarity criteria is, you're basically subtracting one from the other. So you get these two sharp peaks sort of at the edge of the image, wherever the slope of the image is very steep. And that is enough to cause a large enough numerical error in calculating the similarity that it can bias you towards a nearby projection. So in other words, if you do one pixel accuracy alignment, and you look at sort of the spread, how accurately can, you know, so I say I've got a particle I know is in this orientation, it's really noisy, and I look at how accurately I can classify it, you get this sort of Gaussian. If you do one pixel accuracy, you get a Gaussian this wide. If you do a finer accuracy alignment, the Gaussian actually gets visibly narrower. Okay, so the accuracy is visibly improving. Now you say, well, how do I do a sub-pixel accuracy alignment? And the answer is, we're not really interested in the alignment parameter here. We're not trying to get out the fact that it was a half a pixel shift. What we're trying to get out is the minimum possible variance between the two curves. So what we do is we use a minimization algorithm, which allows for sub-pixel translations and uses as its minimization criteria the variance between the two images. So basically, we're saying that our criteria for doing the subpixel resolution alignment is that we're trying to minimize the variance between the images with all of this interpolation taken into account. The accuracy of the translation value that you got out may not be correct. I might not get 0.5 out if I did that, but I would definitely get the best possible value I could get out for the variance. So Eman currently uses something like a 0.04 pixel accuracy alignment. And that actually made a fairly substantial, that made about a one angstrom resolution improvement when we implemented that. Now that process was done when we were going from 11.5 angstroms down to 6 angstroms. Okay, the next thing I'm going to talk about impacts both classification and this class averaging process. So, measures of similarity. I'm very happy that Paul gave this long talk on measures on various similarity measures, because I won't have to go into any of this stuff in great detail. But there's a lot of different ways you can say, oh, I've got an image here, I've got an image here. How similar are they to each other? Now, you have to ask that question in a variety of contexts. You have to ask that question when you're aligning the images. You also have to ask that question when you're determining how similar this image is to another image. Now, you can use correlation coefficient, and as Powell showed, variance between the images is actually exactly the same as correlation coefficient mathematically, unless you're doing some funny stuff in real space to the variance. So if you're doing a pure variance, that's true. But so what I'm going to be talking about in the next few slides is some sort of modifications of the variance, which allow you to get better results in your 3D reconstructions. You also have things like phase residual or mutual information, which are used in a lot of fields, but I'm not going to spend any time going over that. Now, keep in mind when I'm talking about variance here, there are various mathematical tricks you can use to computationally get the variance more efficiently than what I'm going to show you, but I want to put it in variance terms because it's easier to understand. So let's say I have a reference image, and I have another image I want to compare to it. Now, when I collect my image in the electron microscope, there's an arbitrary linear transformation that's applied to the image, right? We don't know where zero is, we don't know where the mean density is, and we don't know how strong it is with respect to the projection that we're trying to compare it to. So it may be that the image is going to be dim. You know, so all right, yeah, I should explain what we're looking at here. So here are the images, and what we're looking at here is a one-dimensional slice through the image. So it's a profile through the image. And this just lets us see relative shifts in density a lot easier than you can in this sort of image here. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this image minus this image and then, you know, take the square difference. So if we integrate over this, we get the variance, basically. If we sum over all of the values in here, we get the variance. But this way, we can sort of see what's happening on a per pixel basis. Now, if we just do this without doing any scaling, obviously we get a terrible answer. I mean, you get this humongous variance between the images because they're scaled differently. So the trivial thing to do would be say, all right, well, I'm going to normalize these images before I do that. And in Eman, typically what we do is we do an edge normalization. So that means we set the value around the edge of the image to be 0, and then we set the standard deviation to 1. And there's reasons we use the edge, set the edge of the image to 0, because when we do masking, that allows us to do some special tricks. So we'll go ahead and look at that. So now we're normalizing this image and normalizing this image, and then we calculate the variance. And you can see on the previous slide, you probably couldn't read it, but the previous slide, the scale of this is like 5 up here. And now the variance is, the peak variance here is like 0.2. And I say, okay, well, now when I was looking at these images, I thought they were identical. But they're obviously not identical. What's going on here? So what I did is when I made the projection image, I imposed CTF on these two particles. And what I said is, well, when I measured my CTF parameters, my amplitude contrast was a little bit off. And that's very common. You can't really determine amplitude contrast very accurately in that fitting process, even if you have a good structure factor for your data. So there's a substantial amount of uncertainty. So my amplitude contrast was a little bit off. So this has a slightly different amplitude contrast than this. But nonetheless, that's what I'm going to be comparing with when I do my classification process. So, you know, I have this CTF corrected reconstruction. If I want to classify my particles, I have to take the projections and I have to apply the CTF that I believe is present in the image to the projection before I can compare them to each other. So when I apply the CTF like that, I'm going to induce some artifacts. And so you can see if there's even a slight disagreement between between the amplitude contrast, I see a non-zero variance here. Now, the problem with some of these CTF artifacts is the effect that they can have in real space is to make the overall normalization of this central region with respect to the edge different. So, you know, you've seen some of the artifacts that you get in the CTF are these black rings outside. So what can happen is this whole section could get sort of shifted down, and then there's a little bit of a ring that comes up here. So it'll move up and down, but the background is still at a fixed value. So if you then normalize this image and normalize this image and then subtract them, you'll get this big error still in the center. It's not sort of optimally subtracting the image that you're interested in. And the answer is Powell sort of implied to that question is, well, you have to do some sort of masking. Okay? So what we do is we basically, we've got some sort of a mask that's been imposed on our three-dimensional model. Now, we've done the mask. We can talk about how that affects resolution in a separate discussion. But so we've got some sort of a mask that's imposed here. And it's a very soft mask. But eventually, it ends up at exactly zero. So a bunch of these pixels in the image are exactly zero. So what we'll do is we'll say in real space now, we're going to ignore any pixels that are exactly zero when we're doing this fitting. Powell showed those linear plots and how he's sort of fitting a line through the plots. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the same thing he did. We're fitting a line through the plot, but we're going to ignore any values where the value is exactly zero. So if we do that, now watch what happens to the curve over here. We actually get a slight improvement in the measure of variance. And you can see also how it's subtracted a little bit differently up here. So the variance actually gets a little bit smaller when you do that. And that first stage improvement to the variance calculation already has a noticeable impact on the classification quality. Now, there's another issue that we have to take into account here, which is that the 3D reconstruction is going to be at some reasonable resolution, and you will have filtered it in some way. If you follow Powell's recommendation, which I fully agree with, and you know, apply some sort of a Wiener filter to your model, your 3D model is going to be a lot higher resolution than the raw particle image. Right? The particle image has this B factor applied to it from the microscope, so it's going to be fuzzy. So now we're doing this we've aligned it in real space, and we're going to do this comparison. And even though we've tried to apply the CTF parameters, we still have this sort of Wiener filter parameter that we can't deconvolute very accurately. So there's going to be some difference in filtration between this image and this image. And when you do that, now your differences get pretty large again here. So the next improvement that you can make is you can say, okay, I'm trying to classify this particle. I'm going to assume, for the sake of argument, that the particle that I'm trying to match to is correct. That I'm going to calculate the power spectrum of this particle, and I am going to filter this particle such that its radial power spectrum looks exactly like the radial power spectrum of this. Now, those of you who have done crystallography or something would say, well, why don't you just use a phase residual or something like that ignores radial filters? Well, then you're not taking amplitudes into account at all. If you apply this sort of radial matched filter to the projection particle before you compare them, then you can still take the azimuthal amplitude variations into account when you do the comparison. So it's a little bit better. So we have this comparison in E-man. We've got several different similarity criteria you can use. And the criteria that performs the best, and the one that was used for all the reconstructions I showed, is the one which does all of these things. So you take your raw particle image, which is noisy, you apply a Wiener filter to it based on the CTF parameter determination that you made earlier. You then filter the reference that you're comparing to match the radial power spectrum of the Wiener filtered particle. You then normalize the reference density to the particle. So you do this thing that I was talking about with ignoring the zeros and the normalization, and then you calculate a variance. So just the simple question of how similar is particle A to particle B becomes fairly involved when you're really trying to get into the nitty gritty of how some of these software packages operate. If I went back and used the original dot product, the maps would still be stuck at 10 angstrom resolution right now. So, okay, next topic. So I mentioned that the one big difference between sort of the canonical spider refinement and the refinements that are the normal refinement routine in Eman is this align and class alignment and the class averaging procedure, basically. So in Spider, typically what you do, and again, you can do whatever you want in Spider. You're writing your own scripts, right? But the typical procedure, when you're so-called classifying the particles, what you're really doing is you determine the Euler angles of the individual particles. In our case, we're not strictly determining the Euler angles. What we're doing is we're grouping particles together that happen to be in the same orientation. And then we're going to try and align the particles to each other to make them look as similar Actually, Powell talked about that the other day a little bit, right? Where you take a group of particles. Oh, no, sorry. Joachim talked about that as being one of Powell's algorithms. So you have a bunch of particles that are in random orientations, and you sort of align them to each other to try and come up with a class average. And that can eliminate a lot of bias problems. So I want to take you through a little bit of my own sort of take on the initial model bias problem. And I like looking at my daughter a lot more than some of these scientists that are typically used for these reconstructions. So I'm going to show you something akin to what you saw, I guess, in Nico's talk the other day, but from a slightly different perspective, because I have a slightly different solution for the problem than he does. So what we're starting with here is some base image. We're adding a certain amount of noise to the image, and then we're translationally aligning it to a reference. And just like what you saw in Nico's result, the more particles you add, the stronger the image you get. Now, we'll do the next logical step. We're actually going to use this as a base image, and we're going to add a lot of noise to that. So we've got about 10% contrast here, signal-to-noise ratio of 0.1. And then we're going to align these to the reference. And as you can see, it's better than the previous case, right? I mean, you can see that the face comes out with a smaller number of particles. Now, when you're at the level where you can actually successfully do the alignment, the signal, any signal that's present in these things that's the same from one image to the next, will go up as linearly with n, whereas any noise will only go up as a square root of n. Okay, so getting an image out of noise is a lot harder than getting an image out of signal, basically. So even if the signal is fairly weak. Okay, now the next experiment we're going to do is we're going to align this, which is form the noisy data here, to this image. Now, before you say, oh, that's your son. No, that's actually my daughter when she was younger. So, unfortunately, what you get out is, well, you can make it look like what you're aligning it to instead of what's actually present in the image. And this is one of the big problems. You say, oh, my God, well, this is terrible. I'm going to have this horrible model reference problem. So, how do we get around this problem? Now, you'll note it's not perfect, right? We have this sort of shadow over here and stuff like that. But still, it certainly looks a lot more like this than it looks like that, right? So let's take a step back and look at some possibilities here. So now I've done exactly what I did in the first case, but I just used the other reference image. What I'm going to do next, instead of just aligning the noisy images to this reference, I'm going to do that. I'm going to align the noisy images to the references, and I'm going to make an average. But then I'm going to align the noisy particles to the average and make a new average. And then I'm going to align the noisy particles to the new average and make another new average. Okay? What happens after you've done that four times is you can see that the signal begins to fade. If you do it eight times, the ghost image is basically gone. Okay, what happens in the case... Now, this was when I did it with perfect noise, right? What happens in the case where I actually had some signal present? Okay, it's low contrast. It's only 10% contrast. So one iteration, I end up with what I showed you before, this. Now, if I then do what I showed you before, and I iterate it four times, I get back what was in the signal, not in the noise. So that's the fundamental idea in the algorithm that we use for class averaging. We iteratively, so we actually do start by aligning the particle to the projection image. It gives you some place to start. And if you do enough iterations of this process, it won't matter in the end anyway. So the algorithm that was described the other day was actually completely unbiased by the reference. But that causes certain other problems with centering and stuff like that that we want to avoid. So in Eman's implementation of this routine, you take all of your particles, you align them to the reference, you make a new average, you align them to the new average, and you iterate that process several times. And then at the very end, you take whatever result you got out, the final average you got out, and you align it to the original projection again. That makes sure that you haven't gotten any sort of rotational, translational drift during the process. But you're not biasing it towards your final structure in any particularly strong way. Now, you can control how many iterations you do that. That's one of the options in the refinement. So if you only do one iteration of the process, you're going to have a lot more ghosting problems than you would if you do 10 iterations of the process. One of the other problems, though, is if you look at this carefully, you'll notice that while we got an image that looks more like this out, as was pointed out the other day, this image is blurrier than this image. And that's because the final alignment that we did was with respect to, we were aligning these to something like this instead of aligning them to something that's crisp and sharp like this. So on the positive side, you get rid of your model bias. But on the negative side, the more iterations you do, the blurrier your class averages get. And that's not a blur that you can undo by reverse filtering or something like that. It's not understood. It's not, you don't understand enough about the image to take it out again. So there's kind of a trade-off here. So typically what we do is you will use a large number in the first few rounds of refinement. And then as you've gotten to some particular resolution, and say, okay, I've converged to such and such a resolution, now I'm going to try and push the resolution further, then you gradually decrease the number of iterations, or sometimes you do it as a step, but you decrease the number of iterations you use. Now, we never entirely turn this mechanism off. If you completely turn the mechanism off and you just do the one-stage alignment, then you'll end up with noise bias building up again very quickly in your structure. But even one iteration of that process is sufficient to pretty much eliminate noise bias from your reconstruction. Some people even sort of take it another step further if they're really trying to, you know, eke the best they can out of their structure, or maybe even cheat a little bit, and they'll actually sort of alternate. They'll do zero iterations. In other words, they'll turn this mechanism off for one iteration, and then they'll turn it back on with a couple of cycles for the next iteration, and then they'll cycle a few times like that. And that can actually be useful. I mean, because it basically you're sitting at the bottom of this energy well, and it's a noisy surface, and that sort of allows you to sort of bounce around in the bottom of the well, and it can be used to sort of get you a slightly better answer sometimes. But it's a very time-consuming process. Okay. So let's see. Okay, one other minor comment I'll make is there was some talk about sort of maximum entropy techniques, that sort of thing, the other day. Eman has kind of a poor man's version of that, which we actually use in some of these high-resolution refinements sometimes, which is when you're classifying the particles, instead of saying, this particle looks the most like this projection, I'm going to keep that, you can actually take each particle and put it into the best n classes. You can say, I want you to take each particle and put it into the best five classes. Okay? You say, well, now I'm smearing out my model because I'm putting the same particle in five different orientations. Well, that's not completely true, because actually when we go through this alignment and classification process, we actually throw out the tail of the histogram. So we throw out bad particles in this case. So what you typically do is you say, okay, I'm going to take my particle and I'm going to put it in, say, the five best classes, but then you set the criteria for throwing out particles in this stage of the process to be much higher, so it throws out a larger fraction of the data. You might even throw out 80% of the data, right? Because you've got five times as many particles. In a sense, what that's doing is it's allowing for the possibility that this initial classification that was done might not have been completely accurate. I mean, because that's definitely true, right? There's always some noise in that classification process, and you're never going to get exactly the right orientation. So we get several orientations that could all be possibly correct, and then we allow this class averaging process to decide which is the right one instead of the instead of the original alignment process. So that's another little tweak that can be used sometimes. All right, that's what I just said. And I think so in the future, I would say if any of you are interested in sort of the software development side of things, there is still lots and lots of room for improvement in almost every aspect of this process. It seems like we've been doing this for 30 years now. You know, it should be sort of stabilizing, but I mean, some of the improvements that I talked to you about today are certainly not optimal. You know, Powell is developing these new algorithms for global minimization techniques. The technique that EMAN uses for refinement is actually very good for low resolution and getting initial models. And as you push past sort of the 10 angstrom barrier, it becomes less efficient. I'm not saying you'll get a better answer with another program, but I'm saying it takes more computational power using EMAN than using sort of a global minimization approach. Unfortunately, no one's implemented a global minimization approach yet, so you know, you can't use it yet. And since Powell is sort of working with us partially now, eventually we'll incorporate that kind of thing as well. But there's room for improving the CTF models. We're going to need to do per-particle CTF correction, deal with beam tilt, better 3D reconstruction algorithms. You saw the description of several different 3D reconstruction algorithms the other day. None of the algorithms is really perfect. There's lots of room for improvements there. And overall, you know, the new refinement methodologies overall. And that's about it.
Exciting talk. Now, you said I think you only used 135 out of about 900 micrographs in 2005 in OEL.
Yeah.
I'm your microscopist, I know, isn't a bad microscopist.
No.
So what happened to 85% of the data?
So it's not just one thing. There were a lot of criteria that were used to exclude particles. Exclude micrographs. Sometimes even the best microscopy, there will still be drift in an occasional micrograph. Charging is a big problem, especially when you go down to liquid helium temperatures. So basically, if you saw anything in the contrast transfer function that made you think that there would be drift or astigmatism or something like that, we throw it out. The next thing is contrast. The ice thickness varies across the grid, as you guys are aware of, and the thicker ice produces poorer quality reconstructions. So we only kept the micrographs that had reasonably thin ice. The B factor varies with the focus. When Donghua collected that data, he was actually covered. He didn't actually think about it before he started too much, and he collected all the way out to about 3 micron to focus, and a fairly substantial fraction of the micrographs were collected between sort of 2.5 and 3 microns. And if you're trying to get down to 4.5 angstrom resolution, the best you can do, anything beyond about 2.2 microns, won't work. Can't use it. So.
All right. Other questions?
Said that if you don't have a uniform set of images that represent all the orientations, you should go back to the drawing board and start.
Yeah.
And
so
yet, you start over. And yet you're saying that with GrowEL, you have sort of a biased set of images.
So I don't think that's exactly what Powell said. He did say you had to go back to the drawing board for something, but that was for a defocus variation, if you didn't have the defocus uniformly sampled. He did say something about orientation as well, and I disagree with Powell on that statement. What you need to have a fully sampled reconstruction is connectivity on the unit. You know, if you look at the unit sphere as describing your orientations, if you cover a great circle around the unit sphere, no matter how it twists and turns, then you have effectively a tomographic series, which is adequate for doing a reconstruction. Now, it's true, if you do just a tomographic series around the equator or something like that, that you'll have better resolution in one direction than in another direction, and you have to be aware of that fact. And that's, to an extent, that's the case in GrowEL, because we have largely what we have is top views and slightly tilted views and side views. So some of the 45-degree tilted components in Fourier space there aren't as high resolution as the vertical and horizontal components, but it's just something you have to be aware of in your structure. It's not something that you should view as being fatal. And I think that was Powell's conclusion as well. You should just use one of these 3D signal-to-noise ratio programs that lets you visualize what the resolution variations are. So, yeah.
Criteria
So I would typically, anything over about 5 iterations in that class averaging process is pretty good for getting rid of bias. So what I would do is you set that number to like 8 to 10 or something like that, a large value, and then you iterate it, you do the reconstruction iteration, the big iteration, until it converges with that value, and then you can reduce the value. And you can be pretty confident that you've gotten rid of your model bias. Now, I definitely profess the viewpoint that you should not just refine your structure from one starting model. Even if you are pretty confident you've got a good starting model, you should still modify that starting model in some way at least, or do one of these Gaussian refinements or something like that, and refine from a different starting model to make sure what you're seeing is correct. And that's, I mean, ideally the community would actually require this as sort of a something for publication, right, that you should refine your structure from at least 2 different starting models and then do a Fourier shell correlation between the 2 models and use that as a criteria. The trick is, you know, you've got these opposing viewpoints, right? You've got one viewpoint, which is we want to report resolutions that are high and sort of correlate with what you get in the crystallography community, right? Because if you look at some of these crystallographic refinements and you calculate what you'd get by sort of using the EM criteria, what they call a 2-angstrom resolution reconstruction would be like a 4-angstrom resolution reconstruction. And if you use the conservative EM criteria, that's really, you know, sort of what's happening. And doing that process of looking for bias would make it even worse. So... Well, you can't say there's a correct threshold because your results of your construction aren't the threshold. The results are the volumetric data, right? So you should really do as much interpretation as you can on the volumetric data. Of course, everyone's going to visualize the thresholds, and the answer is you have to use more than one threshold when you're interpreting your map. As you saw, like we were trying to fit the calcium release channel model, to find the various helices, we had to use a couple of different thresholds to see them. Now, in the case of Groyel, things tend to be a little bit more uniform, and one threshold lets you see the helices. But then if you wanted to see the beta sheet, the strands in the beta sheet, you have to use a different threshold, which makes the helices look bad. So there isn't a single good answer to that question. There isn't a good one.
So you told us you have the helix handling process is done both by Newton and by software.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how much overlap there is and if you see and learn from each other.
The overlap is pretty good, and yes, I would say that there were some refinements sort of made both ways. The sorts of things the Helix Hunter was excluding were things that a human would have trouble seeing without being able to sort of go up and down and threshold quickly and easily. So it would happen that at the threshold that the human was looking at, they'd say, oh, that was a helix, right? But then if you lower the threshold a little bit, you see this sort of big lump sort of sticking out the side, and it gets a little flatter looking, right? And the human might not always notice that, whereas the Helix Hunter program would notice it. But the overlap was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't like we got, you know, 50 helices here and 50 helices here, and we only got 5 when you took the intersection. It was like there were 10 helices here and 8 helices here, and 5 of them overlapped.
I believe there are a number of different calcium release channel structures out there. I wonder how different are they and why are they different?
So at the lower resolutions, I would say they all agree very nicely now. In the latest round of high resolution refinements, we have our structure and they have their structure, and there hasn't been much communication yet. I know Nico is working on getting them to deposit their structure to the database, and we're going to deposit ours to the database as soon as what we've published so far is only the transmembrane domain. We're finishing off the analysis paper on the remainder of the structure, and as soon as we send that in for publication, we'll put the structure in the database. That's a solid commitment. And then people can start comparing. But I can't tell you because I can't look at both structures, right?
When you fitted the helices to the transmembrane domain of calcium release channel using Helix Hunter, at that threshold level, what was the calculated molecular weight and how does it compare to the actual molecular weight
once you get to higher resolutions, those molecular weight calculations go all to pot. I mean, they don't work very well anymore. Even at lower resolutions, they're just kind of ballpark figures. I mean, you really have to. There's so much complexity to these models once you get down to atomic resolution that if you use the calculated threshold for the volume of, say, Gro-El or calcium release channel or whatever, you end up with something that's that you just see these sort of filaments through space, you know, and there's no almost no connectivity in the model. And that gets worse and worse as you get to higher and higher resolution.
Ron, did you have a question?
I refined it from several different starting models, and it converged very nicely to the same thing each time. So I can use, in one refinement I used the 6-angstrom model as a starting model, and in another model I used the Gaussian as a starting model. The one that I showed there was not refined from the 6.5-angstrom structure, I don't think. I think that was refined from I made a new starting model based on the symmetry of the structure. So it was started from basically a noisy blob.
Okay, I'm tapping one more question. Scott?
So in your Gro-El asymmetric unit figure, you see some disconnected bits of density. And I wonder if that might be evidence of amplifying noise throughout your refinement.
That's more evidence of when I segmented out one subunit, I got little bits of the other subunit.
Well, even within the volume, you see that, like, especially in
the. You're right. There's always going to be little bits of noise that are left outside the model. I would say actually that the filtration that we do is pretty conservative. That model is somewhat over-filtered, I would say actually, rather than under-filtered. That's a really difficult issue, which is, I mean, if you really want to include some information all the way out to, you know, sort of the 0.5, where the 0.5 criteria is, you know, and you're going to use, say, a Gaussian filter of some sort, then you're going to have some noise in your model, right? But if you use a Wiener filter, then maybe you'll get rid of more of the noise. I mean, if you get rid of the noise entirely, then your model's going to be a lot blurrier than it could be. So there's a trade-off there that you have to make. So there is a mask incorporated into the refinement loop in EMAN, and that's used to make some of these comparisons better. So the box size has relatively little to do with it. Now, we don't mask tightly. I mean, we avoid sort of the gotchas that Powell was talking about. The masks that we use are iteratively constructed independently for each model. So if you do your two independent models, you don't use the same mask on both of them. You use an independently constructed mask on each one, and the masks have a very wide Gaussian. It's usually like 10-pixel wide Gaussian on the edge of the mask. And if you do a test where you take a pure noise image, apply the mask to the pure noise image, and then calculate a cross-correlation, you get nothing. So it's not causing any resolution exaggeration.
Okay, we're going to have to stop.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve.